the headlines. China approves amendments that would see changes to the method for the formation of Hong Kong's Legislative Council and its voting procedures. The monitoring group says more than 500 people have been killed in Myanmar junta's crackdown on protests against the February 1st coup. Protesters gather outside of a court where the trial of a former Minneapolis officer charged with killing African-American George Floyd started. Thanks for joining us. The Chinese parliament has approved sweeping reforms to Hong Kong's electoral system. The reforms have been signed into law by President Xi Jinping. They reduce the number of directly elected seats in Hong Kong's local parliament to 20 from the current 35. That provides room for some 30 seats to be occupied by representatives of various industries. The reforms also require Hong Kong's candidates for office to be approved by a joint vetting committee from both the city and China. The changes were announced earlier this month. Beijing says that they are necessary to ensure that only patriots govern Hong Kong. The city has witnessed anti-government protests in the past months. Fabrizio Goldoni is an analyst and commentator who joins us. What do you think about the changes that have happened here?
Yeah, I think that the new electoral reform that has been introduced actually is extremely positive and important for the city, because it gives the opportunity, let's say, to the people that has been called, we can call the patriots, basically actually to govern Hong Kong, because we don't have to forget that this electoral reform was needed after the introduction of the national security law, because in Hong Kong we did have before riots. Personally, I call we can call also in other way, like color revolution. But in any case, we have riots before. With these people have political motivation and were colluded with external forces. So now is important that the trouble that we have outside doesn't go inside in the legislature. So this kind of reform is exactly this point of this national security law. So we must be sure that the patriots are the people that love China, and the people that are not conflicting with the national security law. It means secession, subversion of state power, collusion with external forces, or even terrorism. Because in the past, we have this experience.
Well, you're going to find opposition. I'm reading out some of the changes that have happened here. You're going to find opposition, for example, to this what's called the new vetting committee, and how it's going to receive help from national security authorities in assessing loyalty to Beijing. Do you think that in the eyes of some, may be controversial?
Maybe controversial, but necessary, because it's important that the National Security Unit check the background of some of the people. I'll make you an example. Some people, for example, they fly to the United States to ask the United States to put sanctions on Hong Kong. Imagine which kind of people we are talking about. It's quite serious, this kind of crimes. These people, they want to do politics. I don't think they can,
Okay, thank you very much for that. Fabrizio Goldoni, analyst and commentator there from Hong Kong. Thank you. Well, China says it welcomes a visit by UN officials to the Xinjiang region amid a row with the West over the alleged abuse of the country's Uyghur Muslim minority there.
The door to Xinjiang is always open. We welcome the visit of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights to Xinjiang. China has already issued an invitation to the High Commissioner for Human Rights to visit China and visit Xinjiang. The two sides have been in communication. The purpose of the visit is to promote exchanges and cooperation between the two parties and not to carry out so-called investigations based on presumption of guilt.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry made the reaction after the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for unfettered access to Xinjiang to verify reports of human rights abuses in the region. Meanwhile, officials in Xinjiang accused Western countries of trying to contain China under the pretext of human rights issues.
The European Union, the United States, the United Kingdom, and Canada have ganged up to use Xinjiang-related issues to engage in political manipulation. The goal is to mess up Xinjiang and contain China under the guise of human rights.
Chinese officials slammed unilateral sanctions against Xinjiang as aimed at undermining the region's stability and hindering China's development. Several Western nations and the European Union have imposed sanctions on China, accusing Beijing of violating the rights of Uyghurs in camps in Xinjiang. China has reacted by imposing retaliatory sanctions. Beijing says the rights violation allegations have been leveled with the aim of spreading lies and disinformation. Monitoring group in Myanmar says more than 500 people have so far been killed in the junta crackdown on anti-coup protests there. The Assistance Association for Political Prisoners says the real toll could be significantly higher. The UN chief, Antonio Guterres, has said it is absolutely unacceptable to see violence against people at such high levels. He has called for a united global front to put pressure on Myanmar's junta. The U.S., Britain, and the EU have already imposed sanctions in response to the coup and crackdown. The military, however, has refused to ease it off. It staged a coup on February 1st on election fraud and detained civilian leaders. Protests have continued unabated since then, calling for civilian rule. Barry Grossman is an international lawyer and political analyst joining us from Bali. So at this point, it's been some time now since the coup has happened, and we can see the crackdown to also have increased, resulting in many deaths. Where do you see this going?
Well, I don't see it going anywhere very quickly. The problem, of course, is that there are many, many different conflicting interests in play as this works its way through to some kind of an ultimate resolution. And, of course, very few of those interests are particularly interested in, for example, the plight of the Rohingya people. The simple fact is that you've got interests ranging from financial interests and foreign investment to foreign involvement to corruption to individual ethnic groups within Myanmar, which in the past have had conflicts with the junta, and a number of other people, including people genuinely interested in good governance and democracy, taking a position regarding this coup d'etat. The problem, of course, is that the kind of violence we're seeing is largely unprecedented. That is, you've got the military going out, literally targeting people, including young children, with live ammunition, burning people alive, using RPGs against nonviolent protesters. And none of this is acceptable. It almost brings to mind the old adage that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And these old fellas that comprise the military junta in Myanmar don't seem at all willing to try some different tactics or strategies in order to get to where they want to go. Quite frankly, I see what they're doing is playing very much into the hands of foreign interests and ultimately not being likely to achieve the sort of outcomes that they're after for themselves or for the people of Myanmar. It's a great tragedy, and I think it's going to get a whole lot worse before it gets better. And of course, none of this comes as a surprise when you consider that Myanmar is another one of those geographic areas, another region in which the U.S. has set itself up to wage essentially a proxy war against the Chinese. And this, of course, happened back in the Obama administration when Hillary Clinton engineered what was famously called her pivot to Asia, a big part of which was to win Myanmar away from the Chinese orbit and bring them squarely into the Atlantic World camp. None of that worked out very well, especially since the former leading lady come de facto president turned out to be no less racist and bigoted and abusive towards the Rohingya minority than the junta itself.
When you talk about the U.S. interest in Myanmar, I'm guessing that one of the factors in the U.S. interest is going to be the, I think, the north western part of Myanmar that borders China. Is that something that the U.S. considers as important when it comes to Myanmar, for it to somehow then be able to penetrate in that area maybe in order to confront China?
Well, undoubtedly, especially since the Northwest plays a key role in Chinese plans, one for establishing a pipeline from what is predominantly a Muslim area in the northern Rakhine province back to China, but also that it seems to have something of a role to play in the much-heralded new Silk Road. Of course, when we get down to the specifics of what the U.S. perceives its interest in the region to be, we can find a fair bit written on the subject in the output of various think tanks, but they tend not to get overly specific, and I think it's a mistake to think of all U.S. interests as being monolithic. Obviously, there are agendas advanced by elements within the security apparatus that are quite different than agendas advanced by the corporate sector, for example. When it comes to the latter, of course, much has been said about potentially mining for rare earth minerals in Myanmar. But I think the bottom line is that first and foremost, the U.S. sees Myanmar as a nation that needs to be removed from China's orbit and influence and tucked squarely and firmly into the Atlantic World fold. And that clearly hasn't worked out very well. It hasn't worked out very well for the junta. It hasn't worked out very well for the Myanmar majority. And it certainly hasn't worked out very well for the Rohingya in Rakhine province or elsewhere in Myanmar.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. Barry Grossman, international lawyer and political analyst. Many thanks. On to India. Daily COVID cases there have slightly dropped from the country's record-breaking tallies over the last 3 days. The Indian Health Ministry has registered more than 56,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. That was below the 60,000 mark after 3 days. The richest state, Maharashtra, accounted for more than half of the new cases. Officials there are now considering whether to impose stricter curbs starting Thursday to contain the rapid spread of the virus. India's total COVID deaths are above 162,000 out of over 12 million cases. Both figures are the third largest in the world. The Brazilian president has been forced to replace several ministers in the biggest cabinet reshuffle since he took power in January 2019. Jair Bolsonaro replaced six cabinet members, including the foreign and defense ministers, who both resigned on Monday. The shakeup comes as the far-right leader faces mounting pressure due to a deadly surge of COVID-19 in the country. In Brazil, the average weekly death toll has nearly quadrupled since the start of the year. The South American nation also remains the world's second worst-hit country in terms of COVID-19 deaths and infections after the U.S. Brazil's official death toll now stands at nearly 314,000, and the total number of cases is above 12.5 million. Black Lives Matter protesters have gathered outside of the court where the former Minneapolis police officer charged with killing African-American George Floyd has gone on trial. The protesters demanded justice for the black man who died in May 2020 after Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck for about 9 minutes. Demonstrations were held as the first day of Chauvin's trial wrapped up following a technical issue. The white police officer is now facing murder and manslaughter charges. During the first day of the trial, a prosecuting attorney said Chauvin betrayed his badge.
Mr. Derek Chauvin betrayed this badge when he used excessive and unreasonable force upon the body of Mr. George Floyd.
Video, television, social media, or any
Blackwell said Chauvin did not follow police procedures and acted callously. Prior to the opening of the court session, the Floyd family's lawyer described the trial as a referendum on the U.S. justice system. George Floyd's death, which was filmed by bystanders, rocked the U.S. and led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. Dwight Reed in Washington, D.C. says that protests are expected in Minneapolis if people feel justice has been denied.
Well, they want justice. They're saying the same thing that they've been saying for a year now, which is that we want justice for George Floyd, and they're repeating that same phrase, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. The infamous words, George Floyd's last words, I can't breathe, obviously have shifted into kind of a phrase that really evokes the spirit of the times right now. And as you pointed out, yes, I think a big part of the message, something implied by many of these protests, is that if justice is not served, that people are willing to come back out onto the streets again, that they're not going to take this sitting down, and that cities like Minneapolis could look a lot closer to how they did last summer.
Tehran reiterates that the only path to reviving the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is for the U.S. to lift all sanctions on the country. This after a new report in the U.S. media said that Washington plans to make a new proposal to Iran.
A senior Iranian official said that Tehran will stop its 20% uranium enrichment only if the U.S. lifts all its sanctions on the Islamic Republic first. The official said Tehran will further reduce its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal if the U.S. does not end all sanctions, warning that Washington is rapidly running out of time. The remarks are in response to a report published in Politico that said Washington is to offer a new proposal to Tehran to jumpstart the talks on the nuclear deal as soon as this week. This comes as the Iranian president has already rejected the notion of talks on the nuclear deal. Hassan Rouhani said, since Washington did not sit for talks when it left the deal, its return to the agreement also merits no negotiations but a mere political will.
The proposal asks Iran to halt some of its nuclear activities, such as work on advanced centrifuges and the enrichment of uranium to 20% purity in exchange for some relief from U.S. economic sanctions.
After a year of full compliance with the agreement following U.S. withdrawal, Iran gradually started to scale down its nuclear deal commitments because the European parties to the accord, under pressure from the U.S., failed to meet their obligations. Iran says its countermeasures conform to the terms of the deal that allows one side to reduce commitments when others do not honor theirs. Since taking office, U.S. President Joe Biden has followed his predecessor Donald Trump's policies vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Experts believe U.S. policies toward Iran have always been hostile, irrespective of who is in charge of the White House.
The U.S. is determined to overthrow the Iranian government, but it cannot overthrow the Iranian government. And so here we have a situation where the U.S. policy can't really succeed, and the U.S. politicians won't back away from a consensus position that exists within the American establishment.
The Biden team has repeatedly said Washington is open to talks with Tehran, stressing that the ball is in Iran's court to revive the accord. Washington says Iran must first return to full compliance, and the U.S. would then rejoin the accord. Iran has, however, rejected the U.S. position, stressing that Washington must take the first step and lift all sanctions because it was the U.S. that left the agreement in the first place.
A convoy belonging to the U.S.-led military coalition has been targeted in southern Iraq. Security sources told local media that the convoy carrying logistical equipment was targeted by a roadside bomb. The incident happened in Dikar province. There's been no immediate word on possible damage or casualties. U.S.-led forces and their supply convoys have repeatedly come under attack in the past months. The attacks have happened as sentiments run high against the presence of foreign forces, especially American troops. Those sentiments began to rise after the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani last January. After the killing, the Iraqi parliament voted for the withdrawal of U.S. forces. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A a diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
As a reminder, we said that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, highly respected the source of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Hossein Brujadi, and tried to support him as the main source of emulation and decision-maker in seminaries. Thus, even in political issues, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, would advise students and religious scholars of ulama to follow Grand Ayatollah Brujadi in a bid to prevent division among seminaries. In response to a group of friends who had asked him to interfere in political affairs, the Imam said, "My duty in this period is to study and teach, and until Grand Ayatollah Brujadi is alive, I have no duty but to accompany him, give him consultation, and be in harmony with him." Stay tuned for more. Due to his political acumen, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, would always be consulted by Grand Ayatollah Brujadi. In fact, Grand Ayatollah Brujadi would avoid expressing his view on political issues before consultation with Imam Khomeini. Hujjatul Islam Mehri, referring to the meeting of Grand Ayatollah Brujadi with officials of Pahlavi regime, said, "I was at the presence of late Grand Ayatollah Brujadi that a representative came from the government and called for his agreement with the issue that he was going to implement. Grand Ayatollah Brujadi said, 'I will announce the answer to the government after consultation and exchanging views with some of the ulama.' I thought with which of the ulama he would consult over such issues. After a short while, I saw that Imam Khomeini came there at the request of Grand Ayatollah Brujadi and went to a room with him and talked for an hour. After an hour, Grand Ayatollah Brujadi sent his view to the government. Sometimes Grand Ayatollah Brujadi, in addition to consultation on important political issues, would invite the Imam to participate at the negotiations that he had with the government officials, or on behalf of him, talk directly with government representatives and officials." Imam Khomeini's stance on Nawab Safavi's sentence to death was very harsh and instructive. The Fadayana Islam group, led by martyr Nawab Safavi, believed in military action against the despotic regime of Pahlavi, and that's why he had been sentenced to death. But Grand Ayatollah Burjali thought that the regime would not execute him. In view of this, he didn't make much effort to release Nawab Safavi. Yet Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was strongly opposed to execution of Nawab Safavi and his companions, although he was also opposed to military move against the regime. For this reason, the Imam had a lot of consultations with Grand Ayatollah Burjali to prevent their execution. The Imam's efforts were not successful, but he refused to take any measure to keep the status of the source of emulation. Hujjatul Islam Fakhir Yazdi said in this regard, Imam Khomeini had gone to Grand Ayatollah Burjali's house so that he might show a reaction against the execution of Nawab Safavi. The Imam was so upset that he threw his turban to the floor, saying, Sir, support this Sayyid whom they want to execute. Grand Ayatollah Burjali failed to prevent the execution of late Nawab Safavi, and the treacherous Shah martyred the innocent Sayyid. If the Imam had come out instantly and shouted, he would do an illegitimate act. Although he wanted to prevent the execution of Nawab Safavi, keeping the respect of Grand Ayatollah Burjali as the just jurisprudent and source of emulation in those days was more important than safeguarding Nawab. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was so sharp and clever in political affairs that Ayatollah Khashoggi had also predicted his effective role for the future of Islam. The Imam started struggle against the despotic regime of Muhammad Reza Pahlavi as a young scholar at the seminary school. He was so outstanding in politics that once Ayatollah Khashoggi said, the only person that is hoped to benefit the Iranian nation is Mr. Khomeini. Grand Ayatollah Burjadi had also said, I want to help this young man in a proper time so that he would be effective for Islam and Muslims. Although Imam Khomeini was a little upset with Grand Ayatollah Burjadi due to the issue of execution of Nawab Safavi by the regime, he would never allow anyone to speak ill of Grand Ayatollah Burjadi. Later, Ayatollah Ashraqi, the Imam's son-in-law, said, I had just become a member of the Imam's family. It was summer and he had gone to the city of Hamadan. At that time, apparently, he was not in a good terms with Grand Ayatollah Burjadi. I went to visit the Imam in Hamadan. I thought that it wouldn't be bad to criticize Grand Ayatollah Burjadi. As soon as I started speaking about him, the Imam was cross and put his head down. Then he raised his head and said, Mr. Ashraqi, I won't let anyone insult the leader of Muslims, no matter who he is or which position he has. Grand Ayatollah Burjadi's highly respected Imam Khomeini, although he had difference of opinion with him. In many cases, he would designate the Imam as his plenipotentiary representative for resolving problems. One of Imam Khomeini's daughters, Farideh Mostafavi, says in this regard, before the 15th of Khordad uprising, whenever the traders of Tehran would come to Grand Ayatollah Burjadi to assign a congregational prayer leader for them, he would say, if Hajar Ruhollah Khomeini accepts the leadership of that mosque, he is the best person.
the debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Coffee the Halfway. The U.S. social media giant Facebook has banned Press TV page again. Press TV has decried the move as censorship and an attack on free speech. The platform cited violations of its, quote, community standards as the reason without an explanation. In this edition of the debate, we will question what Facebook's definition of community standards is and whether this U.S.-based social media platform has political motives when it decides to close down media outlets like Press TV, which, by many accounts, hurts Facebook's own image of being unbiased. Facebook has once again shut down the page of Press TV News Network, this time permanently, in yet another attack by the U.S.-based social media giant on Iranian media outlets. Facebook said in a note that this decision is irreversible. The company attempted to shut down Press TV's account without giving any prior warning. Facebook justified the act by claiming that Press TV has failed to follow the Facebook community standards. However, the company did not specify the so-called violations of its rules. The social media platform has, on a number of occasions, attacked Press TV, despite its own claim of providing space for freedom of expression. One such attack took place in mid-January, when Facebook temporarily deleted Press TV's page, which had more than 4 million followers. The news outlet, however, had its page restored after appealing the platform's decision to remove it. The attack coincided with Press TV's coverage of post-election violence in the U.S. Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship, not just on Facebook, but also on other fronts, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Over the past years, Facebook, along with other mentioned companies, have repeatedly targeted Press TV, among other media outlets of Iran, and the countries critical of the West, and the Israeli regime's occupation of Palestine. It appears that the UK has also followed the footsteps of the US when it comes to censoring media. The UK broadcast regulator Ofcom recently stripped the Chinese media company of operating on its cable network, an exact move that it did to Iran's Press TV back in 2012.
I think we need to recognize that in today's day and age, the various social media, in particular we're talking about Facebook today, is being weaponized in the tools of the Western powers to actually try and make sure that the agendas that Western powers have are going to be promoted, and anyone that is resisting or saying different things to what the Western powers want to hear and want other people to hear outside, they're going to try and make sure that those voices are suppressed.
Joining us for this edition of the debate, journalist and political commentator Marwa Osman joins us from Beirut. We also have broadcast journalist Richard Methurst, who joins us from Vienna. I'd like to welcome you both. Richard Methurst, first over to you. It's a sad day for the freedom of expression, I have to say it. But your reaction to Iran's Press TV Facebook page, which had over 4 million members, and how Facebook shut it down without prior warning for what it claimed was Press TV's failure to follow, quote, its community standards.
Thanks for having me on. So, I mean, my initial reaction is it's despicable, but I'm not surprised because, you know, this is part of the general agenda that these big tech companies have, these Silicon Valley companies have, which is executing the agenda of the national security state. So, you know, outlets like Press TV, like CGTN, like Telesur, they're constantly harassed. They're constantly having their pages and accounts shut down because they can't have adversarial points of view. They can't have anti-imperialist points of view, you know, opinions that challenge U.S. hegemony and the occupation, the Israeli occupation of Palestine. You know, these are topics that cannot be touched. And so they use bogus arguments like, Press TV is violating the community standards, but they don't actually provide any examples of that or any justification. And the fact that they have a monopoly on the big tech market, these companies like Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, it gives them this immunity that they can get away with, and no one is going to hold them accountable because they want to have their cake and eat it both. They want to be treated as a as a platform, while also taking decisions that a publisher would undertake, which is to censor, which is to control, which is to pick and choose what they allow on the platform. And you will never see CNN or BBC have their pages taken down. You know, this only happens to Press TV and to CGTN and to Telesur, which also had their page removed by Facebook in 2018. At the time, Facebook couldn't even give a proper reason. They kept they gave three different reasons and then reinstated the page finally. And it's just another way to harass foreign outlets and adversarial journalism.
Well, let's talk about the foreign outlets and what Richard Medhurst, Mauro Osman called adversarial journalism. If I'm listening to this from the outside, I'm going to tell myself, well, if they're being banned, I want to go after what they're saying, because obviously they're saying something that is irking these tech giants. Why is it that they are allowed to do that and to continuously do that, and coincidentally, the countries like Iran, like China and Russia, not to mention Venezuela also, are their targets? I mean, what is it that puts Facebook and social media platforms like it on this footing with these countries?
Anya, there's something that very important that you said, Kaveh, at the beginning of this show, when you said that they target media outlets that have an anti-imperial, anti-colonial message. And we're not only talking about Iran or Venezuela or, for example, Russia and China. There's also Iraq, Syria, Lebanon. There's Yemen, Al-Masira, Al-Manar, Al-Itijah in Iraq. There are also journalists and influencers who also share this content on their pages, even if they don't work for any of the above-mentioned media institutions. They are also harassed. They are also having their pages maybe at some point restricted, at other points deleted completely, like they did with Press TV. And this is not the first time. I could remember myself when I was working at a different TV channel back in 2014, when I was covering even the Syrian elections. I posted a video by Press TV while working for another media outlet, because it was an absolute truth coming from the ground, from the people who went on and voted in the elections. And my post was restricted, and I was given some sort of punishment, if you will. It was a 7-day punishment, and at that time there was no live feed, but I was punished 7 days. I wouldn't be able to open it. Mind you also, this is just an extension of what has been going on with the satellite monopoly as well, because what we see right now in the Facebook or in the social media outlets banning such freedom of expression coming from the other side, from the other camp, from the opposing camp of U.S. imperialism. We have seen it before with satellites, but Press TV has been banned on several satellites, Al-Manar. You can't watch them unless you get them on websites, and at certain points, if you even go to Al-Manar or Press TV or Al-Alam website in the U.S., for example, you might get feds knocking on your doors. That happens to my direct cousin who was living in New York. He used to watch Al-Manar on and Al-Alam TV as well, which is an Iranian English-speaking, Arabic-speaking channel, and he was called up by the feds for using this website. I mean, you could use websites to promote violence. You could use websites to promote intolerance, to promote Daesh and terrorism, to promote whatever you want from the liberal culture that is opposing to any Islamic culture, and it's for free, and it's freedom of expression, and it's freedom of thought. But God forbid you try and tell what's going on the ground from the native people, whether in Iran or in Syria or in China or in Russia or Venezuela or in Cuba, for example, and you get banned via satellite, you get banned via social media. This is just an extension. This just shows how the corporations, the conglomerates that are owning the media dissemination throughout the world is actually in control of everything that happens, everything that is being said. Mind you, they label them as state-owned or state-funded. What do you call CNN? What do you call BBC? Are they not state-funded? I mean, come on, BBC Radio gets around $80 million per year just for propaganda funding. Just think about how much that amount of money would be for BBC TV and all of its TV channels. This is just absurd. It's typical colonial mindset. And at the end of the day, they actually admitted the censorship. Facebook admitted the censorship back when General Soleimani was martyred in Iraq, and people were sharing his photos, people who were saved by this man and by the likes of this man. They were celebrating the martyrdom of this man, and they got suspended. Press TV, I think at that time, it got its pages also suspended. Why? Because basically, he falls under what the U.S. calls sanctions, and Facebook admits that it goes along. It is just the extended hand of the U.S. Treasury.
Right. You know, I can't forget the time, Richard Medhurst, when the Syria war, I think it was a year old, into the protests that were going on. And there was coverage that mainly coming from CNN, I remember very distinctly, of this reporter who was reporting on the protests that were happening. And yet he wasn't in a place that protests were happening. There was protest sounds that were ongoing, and he had rehearsed. The rehearsal was actually caught before tape of how many people should be reported to be killed by him. And then Anderson Cooper comes on and says, how many people are killed? And he said 40 in the first hour. And this type of take on fake news, I should say, disinformation was being spread that way. And it became known, not only CNN, but other media outlets. So why is it that that's not being put into focus and part of the conversation, but rather you have, you know, channels like Press TV, and others that you mentioned be the target?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And, you know, I also recall how they were saying on television that, you know, there were protests in the Saht al-Abbasin, which is a square in Damascus. That, you know, you know, I'm a few minutes away, and my reaction is to go there and see what's going on, and there's absolutely nothing happening there. So just blatant disinformation, blatant lying, and a full-on propaganda war, and that's been half of the conflict on Syria. It's not just been bombs and weapons. It's also been propaganda, words, ideas, and constant fake news, as you mentioned. And, of course, they're never subjected to that, right? It's totally okay for these channels that are you know, completely state-funded and run by the British and American governments to lie the entire time. They're never going to have their pages taken down or, you know, have any kind of labels under their tweets. And I'm not saying that they should be completely censored or something like that. I'm just saying that it's a double standard that needs to be pointed out. You know, if they're going to be allowed to lie and to propagate misinformation and start wars, literal wars, like they did with Iraq, like they did with Syria, like they're trying to do with Iran all the time, then they can't come around and then accuse Press TV of lying or other channels of lying when they're not really. I mean, our reporting is factual. We're talking about what's happening on the ground and exposing that. And because it's factual, they're trying to censor that and you know, block us from educating people. And I think it's completely despicable. And, you know, as we pointed out, this doesn't happen just to adversarial channels. It's also happened to independent journalists. I mean, I myself had my YouTube channel demonetized last year because I was covering Israel very heavily, especially on the verge of this annexation plan that was set to take place on July 1st. So, and just in the last couple of weeks, you've had a slew of independent channels on YouTube completely demonetized or removed. I mean, it's disgusting. And they're just an extension of the national security state. And we know this because, you know, what more receipts do you want from 2013 after the Snowden revelations, that all these companies, Facebook, Apple, YouTube, Microsoft, they're all working with the National Security Agency. They're all, you know, in bed with the National Security State. We know this for a fact. It's not even a secret anymore. And so, you know, it's absolutely disgusting how they can lie and start wars based on complete fabrications, and they get away with it. They get away with murdering millions of people, and yet they come around and they want to lecture us about, you know, so-called disinformation. I think this is it is really an expression of a colonial mindset, as we just pointed out.
So we're looking tomorrow, Azwan, at a slew of topics that perhaps are hot-button topics for Facebook and other Western media and social websites, of course Facebook being one of the big ones. And I think one of the ones that raises a red flag right away is Israel. So anything that has to deal pretty much with Israel is going to be under the microscope when it comes to Facebook. And we know that obviously Iran's Press TV is very critical of Israel and the legal actions that it exercises in the occupied territories. How much of a role does Israel play in this? Because many say that Israel is one of the influential factors when it comes to decisions that are being made, such as in this case, Facebook, with regards to Press TV.
Well, it's always been said that just look on who you can criticize, and that's who's controlling you. And that's basically what's happening with the social media platforms, with it, just like it happened with conglomerates of media corporations around the world owned by people who either have an Israeli citizenship or are very good friends with the Israelis. And that's not new. I mean, if you go back to what happened in 2008 and in 2012 in Gaza, you find absolutely nothing about it in the U.S. Sponsored or the Western regime sponsored mainstream media. What happened in 2006 in Lebanon, what happened later on in Syria, how it started. People keep saying that it was supposedly an uprising. No, it was never an uprising. Syrian security officers were being ththrown off bridges in Daraa. That's how it started. They were being shot at. And we have footage of that, but we cannot show you that footage. Why? Because we would get censored. Example, what happened with Press TV. Or we personally, the people who actually, me personally, I was censored. I'm never allowed to go live on Facebook anymore, because at one time I just took my phone, my village is right across the, right on the border with occupied Palestine. I wanted to show the world how Israel is actually erecting an apartheid wall all the way on the border crossing between Palestine and Lebanon. I just showed that video, I was cut, and then was never allowed to go live on Facebook again. Again, just like what happened with Richard with monetizing, I was never allowed to monetize my channel to begin with, but at the same time, a lot of my videos, especially my show that I'm producing and presenting for Press TV, when I touch upon topics of occupation and topics of apartheid by Israel, they either get removed and I have to appeal and show them that it's actually facts, because I never get anything without credible sources. And majorly, I try to use as much of their sources, which they tend to hide, especially from Reuters and AP and AFP, and use them in my reports just to make sure that my videos end up actually not being removed. Same thing with Press TV. Press TV gets its reporters on the ground. They are natives, usually, most of the time they're natives, getting information from the people who are being sanctioned, who are being killed, bombed. And at the end of the day, they get sanctioned themselves, removed themselves from social media for telling the truth.
Okay, Richard Medhurst, so let's try to put things into perspective and really spell this out and make the viewer that's watching this realize what is going on, at least the way that I'm looking at it. I don't know if you agree or not. So you have the mainstream media in the West, in the U.S., outlets like CNN from the U.S. or BBC from the U.K., and they're spelling a narrative through their government-funded news channels. And then you have Iran's, for example, Press TV and its websites and its social media accounts that perhaps what they're saying runs counter to what they are saying, especially in the foreign policy arena, like the war on Syria, like the war in Afghanistan, and you name it. And that's maybe why Press TV is being targeted. Is that a correct take on this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the major, that's a major crux of this issue, because they need narrative control. They have to have narrative control. If you remember, just for example, the buildup before the war in Iraq, I mean, it was 24/7 brainwashing in the mainstream media, and it serves a purpose. It's to acquiesce the population. It's to make them, swallow this nonsense and accept seeing body bags coming home, seeing billions of dollars, trillions of dollars being spent on military surplus. So they need this narrative control. It's very important. You can't have the population being educated. And, Press TV provides, what Telesur provides, what Sputnik, what RT, what CGTN provide, they provide a completely fresh and different take on things. And as a matter of fact, it's not just a different take. It's oftentimes the truth, the plain old truth, which they're not getting on mainstream media. And you know, it's incredible that they want to talk about state-controlled narratives when we just had a massive leak from Anonymous about the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, which is their State Department, giving out contracts to Reuters and BBC to go and spread anti-Russian propaganda. And also with Bellingcat, which helped push this lie about this chemical gas attack in Douma. And, you know, it's incredible. Like, are they going to have their pages taken down for disinformation? Are they going to have labels put under their tweets or their pages that they're state-sponsored? Of course not. Even though we have receipts, we have documents, we have literal official documents showing that these are not just some kind of random contracts. They were kept secret and confidential on purpose. So there was a nefarious element to this. And so, going back to your your assessment. I agree with it. Yeah, and I think it's all about narrative control, and they must have this because the propaganda machine, it goes hand in hand with the war machine. They're one and the same. And CNN, you know, BBC, mm-hmm. the mainstream outlets, be it on television or the big tech companies, they're all serving the same purpose. They're all serving the State Department and Whitehall.
Okay. Final question, and please, less than a minute, Marwa Osman. So you have, as you've been targeted, as you said in the past, and you may be, you may keep getting targeted, will that stop you? Will that limit
Absolutely.
You? Or will
not
that give you more of
never.
An incentive to go out and do what you're
never.
Doing?
We come from an area where we are now, we are never used to bombs and explosions. We are never going to get used to that. But that doesn't kill us actually really makes us stronger and more steadfast into telling the truth, screaming it to the world, telling them, look, this is what's happening. We are living this. This is exactly what's happening. Same thing with when I get, I had like from 2012 up to 2019, I toured Europe talking about what was going on in my region, in Syria and Iraq and in Lebanon. And every time people would see me, they would think that I was part of ISIS. I would tell them, I would explain to them, like, look, it's not, that's not the truth. We are not like that. I myself dodged an explosion with two of my kids in my car because of ISIS. We gave out the best of our
okay.
men to fight off this thing to keep us protected. And this is exactly what we do. Keep telling the story. Stick to the goals. Our goal is to tell the truth, tell the story no matter what. And at the end of the day, they have something to fear
okay.
about us. We have nothing to fear from them.
Thank you so much. Sorry, but we're just fresh out of time. Let me thank journalist and political commentator Marwa Osman there from Beirut. And thank you, Richard Medhurst, broadcast journalist from Vienna. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tafway, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي.
What non-Muslims say about Ali, the first successor of Prophet Muhammad. Thomas Carlyle, 1795 to 1881, Scottish historian, critic, and sociological writer, in his books On Heroes, Hero Worship, and the Heroic in History, 1841, Lecture 2, The Hero as Prophet Muhammad Islam, May 8, 1840, says the following about Imam Ali alayhi salam. As for this young Ali, one cannot but like him, a noble-minded creature as he shows himself now and always afterwards, full of affection, of fiery daring, something chivalrous in him, brave as a lion, yet with a grace, a truth, an affection worthy of Christian knighthood.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the programs to my brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, one of the great lessons which we learn from Imam Ali is humbleness and simplicity. So regarding humbleness and simplicity, we have a very interesting story, a tradition related in the historical texts about Imam Ali. So one day, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, was wearing a garment, some clothing, that had patches upon this clothing of his. And in this clothing, he went and attended a gathering. Now, an ignorant man, a cruel man, an uneducated man, if you will, started to blame Imam Ali and started to talk down upon him because of the clothes he was wearing. So Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him, said to the man, wearing